We'd like to convene the Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Corrections. Welcome everyone. Today, of course, is February 12th, 2013. President at the committee table are Representative Isaacson, Representative Kawasaki. The topics today are going to be reentry programs and probation parole. As always, we ask everybody to be mindful of your cell phones. Our next meeting is going to be on Thursday, same room and same time, and at that point, we're going to take up an inmate health care programs, the budget recap, and then finish off with the FY14 request. A note to everyone that we are going to attempt to close this budget out a little early, on the 19th of February, to be exact. So just be mindful of that as well, that we won't be having any meetings if things work out beyond that date. So with that, Deputy Commissioners Houston and Taylor, if you would come to the table, please, and we'll begin the presentation. I expect we'll have more committee members joining us here as time goes on. I know Representative Lynn is on his way. Good evening, Leslie.
Thank you, Chairman. Just to introduce, to my right is Carrie Belden. She is the current Director of Probation and Parole, and she succeeded Deputy Commissioner Taylor in that position, and prior to this, Carrie was the Executive Director of the Parole Board. Mm-hmm. And also joining us in the gallery, we have Casey Schroeder, our Special Assistant, Kevin Worley, Director of Administrative Services, April Wilkerson, our Budget Manager, and joining us also tonight from the Department of Law is our Attorney, John Bodick. Okay. Just to give you a brief overview of the budget for probation and parole, in this budget component, there are 142 PCNs, and that's a combination of the director's office and statewide probation and parole. And then there's an additional 17 positions in the electronic monitoring program, so there's 159 total PCNs that are under this umbrella. The FY14 budget, combined with the probation and parole director's office, the director's office represents $15,994,700, and that's combined with statewide probation and parole. It represents 4.9% of the overall DOC budget and about 6.1% of the results delivery unit and population management. And then when you add on, of course, the extra funds for electronic monitoring, and I should mention also the community residential centers are under this area also. And once you add the additional funding, it's about $44,558,800, which represents 13.6% of DOC's overall budget and 17% of population management results delivery unit. And at this point, if there's no questions on the budget, then we can turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Taylor.
Not seeing any questions. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Do you have that written down someplace?
What? Actually, you have in this book, this handout that was handed, I think it was last week,
the budget
session.
Overview?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you'll see in here the breakdown of all the areas of DOC's budget.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ron Taylor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And I'll be going through the probation and parole and briefly over some of the reentry programs that we're doing in the department. I believe last week we talked about the CRCs and electronic monitoring, so I won't spend any time on that. So I'll just focus exclusively on probation and parole today. So if you look on page 2, the department actually went through some reorganization with probation and parole, and I'll talk about our technical assistance that we did about a year ago for probation and parole. But essentially, we looked at our mission to make sure that it was in alignment with the direction the department was going in terms of secure confinement, a process to supervise reentry into the community. And we wanted to make sure that the Division of Probation and Parole's mission actually aligned under the department's mission. So you'll see where the mission was changed to enhance community safety. That's our top priority. We utilize proven practices and effective supervision to improve the successful community reintegration of our probationers and parolees in the communities. So let's talk about our structure. The department has 3 regions and 13 field offices, and each of the region is supervised by a chief probation officer. And you can see the various breakdowns of the regions 1, 2, and 3. The main office in Anchorage, our director's office is also in Anchorage, so that's where Kerry would be housed at. So what is probation?
Representative Kawasaki.
Just a real quick question on the regions. They seem to be geographically very diverse. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why those are that way?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, not really. This okay. was the part of it was part of the caseload breakdown, I believe, through the chair, to make sure that Region 1, I believe, was the one that we had that was heavily overloaded with caseloads and supervision. And so we sort of split up Region 1 and 2 more to make sure that the caseload distribution was equalized between the chief probation officers.
I guess to follow up, when it comes to like the 142 PCNs or 146, what?
159.
Okay, 159, it wasn't exact. If you've got, say, a chief probation officer in one region that has to speak with a person all the way between Barrow and Sitka, does the geographic area make that difficult?
Through the chair, obviously, when you're doing rural supervision, there are some difficulties in doing that. But the person that has been the chief probation officer has been with the department over 20-something years. She's very familiar with each of the areas under her responsibility, so we feel pretty comfortable with what she's doing with Barrow and Sitka and all the areas in between.
Okay.
Thank you. So the next two slides talk about the differences between probation and parole. So what is probation? Probation is a function of the court. So when a person is sentenced for a felony offense, the judge can order that that person be placed on supervision in the community. That's subject to conditions imposed by the court. So they will give probation conditions that that person must abide by. Now, this could be following their release from incarceration, or it could be in lieu of incarceration, but it's a function of the court for probation. Parole is different in that parole allows a person to serve the last third of their time in the community, which is that good time that they've earned, and the parole board is the one that's responsible for doing that. This allows a person to be released into the community with some gradual controls and supervision strategies that the board themselves will order for that person. So, for example, you would see mandatory parole. And under mandatory parole, those persons have come up against their release date, and so they're released to the community with conditions that are imposed by the parole board. And the board also has responsibility for discretionary parole, which is, just like it says, it's discretionary. Based on the type of crime that the person has committed, it could either be a fourth or a third of the time that they must serve while they're in custody before they'd be eligible for discretionary parole. And it's in the board's discretion to release them to parole conditions. And they also do special medical parole, probably about 2 to 3 at the most per year is what they do for special medical paroles. So on page 6, you begin to look at what does a probation officer do. They oversee all the supervision activities that are involved or relevant to a probation or a parolee's on supervision. They assist the offender in reintegrating back into society in a way that will positively enhance or impact public safety. And they work collaboratively with the Division of Institutions, local law enforcement, treatment providers, sex offender treatment providers, the court system, the board, and various other local and community agencies. As I mentioned earlier, the department sought some technical assistance at the beginning of 2012 for probation and parole, and that was to look at what were we doing across the board in probation and parole. Were we effectively supervising people? Let's look at our data to see what our data suggested. And then let's begin to bring in an expert, someone who could help us and guide us in terms of what we could do to improve our services. How could we better increase public safety, reduce recidivism, and enhance the efficiency of our division? And as part of that, I want to just talk real briefly about what we learned in terms of what works and what does not work. So what we found that what works is that when we combine programming with our education, our consistency and swiftness, that is impactful. Well, we found out that punishment and deterrence, when these things are taken into its own context, where we're just going to put somebody back in jail, or we're just going to use our sanctions as a way to deter someone, that does not really have an impact on reducing recidivism or improving public safety. We know that when offender efforts are paired with pro-social or rehabilitation interventions, recidivism rates are reduced significantly.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Could you identify pro-social?
Those things that are positively, through the chair, positively associated, such as positive peer support group, positive activities that they're doing, things that they would have in a social context, but that would be positive for them.
So follow up. So it's pro-social or rehabilitation-oriented interventions. There's some overlap in definitions on that?
Through the chair, that's correct. Some of the pro-social activities may be peer support or community support groups that are out there, such as AA, for example, that would overlap into some of the rehabilitative-oriented interventions, and some aftercare programs that would probably be the same as well.
All right, thanks.
And we also learned that through, I believe it was Steve Olson that came in from the Washington State Institute on Public Policy, that when we're pairing these rehabilitative efforts and pro-social activities with our supervision activities, we find that rearrest rates can drop as much as 20%. As I said, what doesn't work, punishment, sanctions, or incarceration alone. You have a list of programs that the research shows that doesn't work. Intensive supervision or just drug education programs without any accompanying or associated treatment, or drug prevention classes that focus on just fear or emotional appeal. So what did we do? And why are we here in terms of, if we want to be effective as a correctional organization or as probation and parole, the core of what we're focusing on is these three principles: risk, need, and responsivity. The risk principle is who we're devoting our time and energy to, who we're spending our resources, and what we should be doing is devoting those resources to our moderate and high-risk cases. The need principle: what factors have been associated or identified that if offenders continue doing these things, they will have an impact on them continuing in their criminal behavior. And then the responsivity principle, which is the how. In other words, how can we tailor our supervision strategies, focus our conditions, programming, resources, and referrals so that it targets those needs that have been identified earlier? What this means for us is moving our supervision strategies from a custody control model to something on change. So we're moving from custody and monitoring to behavior change, from agency isolation to collaboration, from looking at unproven methods to using what works, from measuring simple inputs to looking at outcomes, and then a real shift from focusing on offender failure to focusing on offender success and improving public safety. And as we look at the three principles, the other things that we're also focused on is what are some of the eight guiding principles that research has shown consistently to be the things that we should be focused on as an organization, and especially as a supervision agency, how should we focus our activities? So if you start at the bottom and move up, it'll start with assessing risk, and then you look at enhancing intrinsic motivation. In other words, we need to find ways to positively motivate people in order to be successful on probation and parole. Target our interventions, that's going back to our risk and need. We need to do a better job of training our probation officers and staff to understand where we're going with our supervision activities. increase and reinforce our positive reinforcement and engage in ongoing support in the community. This for us is part of that reentry continuum in terms of being able to identify support in the community for our probationers and parolees so that they're no longer dependent on either the institutions or probation officers in the community for their support. They have natural supports in the community. And as you can see, the other two are driven by what should cover the entire system, which is measurement, and getting feedback from each part of the system, and looking at our practices and ensuring that there's ongoing an ongoing review of what we're doing in our system to improve it overall. So on page 13, we talk about our risk assessment. We know that when we use a risk assessment versus our gut, we do a better job of identifying those persons who are in most need of resources or most need of intervention. So what we use is the level of services inventory, or the LSI, which was developed by Canadian researchers Andrews and Bonta, and is composed of a 54-item questionnaire that identifies the risk level as well as begin to point out some of the needs that our offenders need to address. And we'll talk about those in a minute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Isaacs.
Thanks. When you talk about this, when do you actually start doing this? It's a function of probation, but I take it it's part of intake as well, or when do you actually start all of the, you know, the 8 guiding principles and such for risk assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, actually some of this is started when they're in custody, when they're actually in the institution. If they're, especially if they're long-term and they've done some of their programming, what we're trying to do is make it a comprehensive system so that the LSI is done up front when they come into the institution and it follows them when they transfer out into community supervision.
Yeah, if I may follow up, I would think that you'd want to have started this while they were incarcerated so that you'd know the likelihood of success in the probation or parole experience.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Isaacson.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. If you look at page 14, what we found when we started looking at our LSI was under our current profile as of, I should say, last year, 62% of our persons in our system were medium, 11% was maximum, and 27% was minimum. And that's how we treated our persons when they came in to be seen by probation officers, or even in custody we were using the same classification or assessment level. What we're now moving to is on page 15, to help us better identify who's at risk, and to help us develop some very tailored strategies to meet those needs, such as increased home visits for those who are very high, for example, or increased substance abuse testing for those who are in serious need of increased substance abuse testing. For our low-risk guys, we wouldn't subject them to the same types of strategies that we would for our high-risk. And so for us moving to this five-tiered system, it helps us to better align our resources with the direction that the department has been going in all along, which is targeting our high-risk offenders. On page 16, we look at the what, or the needs. We know that our risk factors can be divided into both static, those things that won't change, age of first arrest, prior criminal history, and dynamic, such as their substance abuse use at that particular time or criminal peers. It's the dynamic factors that are the most directly linked to criminal behavior, and these are called the criminogenic needs. So by targeting these needs, we have a better chance of reducing recidivism by the number of needs that we target, and I'll cover that on the next slide, or next two slides, I should say. What you see before you are the top 8 criminogenic needs that have been identified in research that consistently show up across all populations, and it starts with antisocial attitudes, the way that people think, the way that they feel, how risky they are, so that they begin to recognize where they are, They have a history of antisocial behavior, low self-control. So what we want to do as part of this is to help them build problem-solving skills and other coping skills. They have a history of hanging around the wrong people, antisocial peers. We need to get them associated with people who are pro-social, people who are more positive in their life rather than their criminal friends. They have a criminal personality makeup, some long criminal histories, dysfunctional family relationships. Substance abuse, as you know, is very high for us in this state. And poor school or work history. So we need to enhance their skills, their training, and certification.
Question.
Representative Lynn.
What part of the criminal personality makeup is a list of what gives somebody a makeup of a criminal?
This is, through the chair, Representative Lynn, this is just referring to the criminal history, just the number of priors or the list of criminal history that they have. So they've constantly been involved in criminal activity or criminal behavior.
Okay, but it's not a social trait or biologic trait. It's number of priors.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Lynn.
Okay. If personality didn't cross my mind on that. Okay.
Thank you, sir. And then the last one would be what type of activities are they're involved in their leisure. We don't want our people just hanging out. We want them doing something positively when they're not reporting to treatment or to the probation parole office or in their downtime. Our next slide is our director's favorite slide, actually. And what it depicts is a person on the left, bottom left, and all of the things, those needs that are right there in the middle. And what we're trying to do is help them get over that. How do we help them not just get over that wall, but stay over that wall? And the better we do in terms of driving down those criminogenic needs, finding strategies and opportunities to reduce those criminogenic needs, the better chance we are to for them not coming back or repeating crime. In fact, if we were just to target one or two or possibly three of those eight, it would have no impact on reducing recidivism. But what research is showing that if you target 4 to 6 of these criminogenic needs, you can actually decrease recidivism by up to 31%, which this is something, especially for our higher risk persons, that if we did a better job of targeting their risk and need and beginning to focus on those criminogenic needs, at least 4 to 6 of those, we could do a better job of turning our curve in terms of criminal recidivism for our repeat offenders and our high violation rates. The responsivity principle is the how. We know that we need to engage more cognitive behavioral components so that we achieve better results with our offenders, that the programs that we design and have been designing, both in custody and out of custody, they need to be adapted to learning styles and abilities, they need to increase motivation, and they need to be culturally and gender relevant as well. In probation and parole, we're also developing, in the future, incentives and sanction matrix for our probation officers so that we can do a better job of responding appropriately and swiftly to those violations as they occur. And we've been working already with the parole board and the court system on violation responses and looking at ways that we can minimize the number of conditions that are given to a particular probationer or parolee when they are released on supervision. I include slide 20, and I know I think it was Representative Kawasaki that made comments on it last time, but in slide 20, what it talks about is the job that we need to do in our probation violations. This was one of our targets that we're going to be focusing on in the upcoming fiscal year, to begin and look at ways that we can drive down the reasons that people are actually coming. One, identify the reason that they're coming back into our system, but two, find ways that we can intervene at a much earlier point them waiting until after they have done something, and then they're back into our system again. So we know that we have, our violation rates have increased from 1,600 in 2002 to well over 2,700 in 2011.
Representative Isaacson.
Well, is that because an attempt to be nicer is getting slapped down, or what? I mean, that's quite an increase.
Through the chair, who's being nicer, us or the offenders, or
you,
who?
You're being nicer, well, it seems, because you're saying on one slide, punishment doesn't work, but on the other, and you know, trying to help them become better citizens, and that's absolutely what we want to make sure of. But at the same time, they're breaking probation. Maybe is there more of a concentration on high-risk people and the low-risk guys get probation? I mean, how does that split out?
Through the chair, Representative Magnuson, we went through a real different time period in terms of probation and parole, where prior to the last year or two, we defined success as arrests and focusing on violations and locking people up rather than looking at different alternatives to arrest or different alternatives to taking that person back to jail. The other thing that we had a heavy emphasis on was the number of conditions. In some cases, for example, parole has 21 standard conditions, and they could have up to 21 supplemental conditions that can be imposed on them at any one time. So the possibility of someone going out and being released on mandatory supervision, you're looking at anywhere from 21 to 42 conditions that are actually being imposed. When we did, as part of our technical assistance, we started looking at that to see if 42 conditions is really necessary for one person, or 21 conditions is really necessary. You know, we found, I think it was close to 13 that was required in statute, and then based on need, we could start identifying where that person are by using the LSR information and saying we need these additional conditions to help support this. So what we're doing now is reorienting a system that's focused on risk and need rather than just loading people up with unnecessary conditions.
So what do you expect the readmission for probation violations to be? How did it pan out in 2012, just initial glimpse? Has the numbers decreased with
just
this new
slightly,
application? Or
through the chair, just slightly, from like 2737 to I think it was 2717. So we're starting to see that, but we really need to start digging in and doing a better job at our violations, which we'll start focusing on at the beginning of the next fiscal year.
So if you're using methods that are proven to work, they're working someplace, and so you're expecting this to be a decline and not a dip, a temporary dip.
Through the chair, that's correct. In fact, what we will be using is exactly what other locations and other researchers demonstrated has been effective in reducing violation rates in other locations.
What about their ability to get employment? Or is that helping to increase their ability to reintegrate, or what's the population that is doing the probation violations? Is there any particular profile on that, any characteristic that you could address or are addressing?
Through the chair, no, there's no real specific profile for the violators. It's across the board, from whether it's our minimum all the way up to our, what we have now is our maximum. So we haven't really zeroed in on who is this person. That's what we're going to start focusing on in the next fiscal year.
Just one more then. So where is it that if you're using methods that are proven to work, but we have this type of increase, it's a delicate question, but an indelicate way of asking, are you sure it's working? Are you sure it's proven to work?
Through the chair, we're just starting to use this.
Oh.
So it's not like this has been in existence for a year or two. I mean, we just got technical assistance in May of this year, just starting to change our risk assessment piece, and then we'll start looking at our violations piece at the basically July of this year.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, kind of on the same lines. Can you explaining this graph so that the 68% technical, they were just technical violations of some sort, which put them back. What's the both? Is that they did a combination of something, or how did that work?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, they would either commit some criminal or legal violation as well as a technical violation.
And I guess just on the same lines as my North Pole colleague, there's 40% more admissions for probation violations over that period. 40% more is what that number would be, and 20% was the caseload increment or increase over the same time. I don't know if it works. I guess we're going to check, but the big criticism from the LSI, risk assessment was that maybe we were not categorizing folks where they should be. So I'll be interested in seeing how the information and data pans out too.
Through chair, thank you, sir. You're correct with that. So our rehabilitative programs on slide 21. I've actually covered some of these in talking about the substance abuse programs that we have put in the institutions, as well as some community programs, the LSAT or the Life Skills Substance Abuse Treatment, and our RSAT program, which is in the community, the Residential Substance Abuse Treatment. And we have some aftercare programs throughout several of our communities. What we're showing right now in our substance abuse program, that's those people who actually participate and complete the program, are showing a 14% reduction over a 2.5-year period as compared to their cohorts. So we are seeing some positive recidivism reduction in our population by moving to some of the evidence programs that we're talking about and some of the research-based programs that we've been discussing. And you can see where we've increased our vocational education programs to well over 1,900 people being served in our institutions for various vocation programs. In fact, I believe you actually have a handout of the list of our programs by institution, so that you can check out whichever institution you're interested in and the programs that we're having. That will also include our Goose Creek program. So I'll just do a quick recap of our PACE and our reentry program on page 20. We go to 23 now. The PACE program actually started in July of 2010 in Anchorage. It's now expanded to Palmer, and there's a misdemeanor domestic violence program in Fairbanks. The initial project focused on 70 high-risk felony probationers. We had a preliminary evaluation that actually showed that the PACE program was successful at reducing positive drug tests. In fact, 66% of the probationers were free of any positive drug tests during their first 3 months. This is in contrast to when prior to their enrollment, when only 20% of those probationers were free of positive drug tests. And if you look on page 25, it'll talk about our prisoner reentry task force. The purpose of the task force is to reduce the recidivism rate in Alaska and improve public safety and the overall health of our Alaskan community. We have three main work groups as part of the prisoner reentry task force. There's a misdemeanor work group that's tailored to look at the misdemeanor problem, the high recidivism of misdemeanors that we have in our system. Substance abuse work group that's looking at treatment issues as well as other substance abuse areas that we could focus, or I should say behavioral health areas, and an employment work group that we've formed a strong relationship with the Department of Labor in terms of identifying ready-to-work programs, rental assistance programs, different opportunities that we are doing in the community as well as the institution to help with certifications and programming. We also have regional reentry coalitions, Anchorage, Kenai, the Mat-Su Valley, Dillingham, and Juneau, and each of those coalitions are geared toward looking at, on a local level, the issues that each of those communities face in terms of having people released from released from custody and returning to their communities. And as you can imagine, in most of these communities, housing and employment, those are our biggest two areas that we're facing as hurdles when we release our persons to each of these communities.
Why wouldn't Bethel be part of this regional reentry coalitions?
Mr. Chair, we just haven't had people in Bethel yet to step up to do a reentry coalition. That's all.
Okay.
And with that, I'll be done with the presentation, sir.
Questions, committee members? I have a question. Just sort of a more on the broader end of things. You know, we all sat through, most of us sat through the Jerry Madden presentation up in Anchorage. You know, I remember him classifying in the thirds. A third of the prisoners, you know, are never going to come back. A third, you know, are just lifers, quote unquote, if you will. I mean, you know, they're not, they can't be rehabilitated. And then there's a third that you really want to impact, if you get to with appropriate amounts of treatments and services, you can maybe turn them in the right direction. So the question is, you know, looking at your cost curve up in finance, you're projecting the next 10 years 3.1% growth, when in fact, over the last 10 years, it's been, what, 7-8%? I mean, which gets to be prodigious after a while when you look at the compounding effect. Are these risk assessment tools going in and identifying the criminogenic characteristics of criminogenic needs, apparently? I mean, is this going to bend that curve realistically without having some, you know, I know these are all part and parcel of smart justice techniques and so forth. A lot of states are doing it. Not everybody's employing the Texas model where you put a lot of money up front and you save having to build the big expensive prisons. But really, is this approach more, or are we sort of nibbling at the edges with this problem of recidivism in Alaska, or is this really going to employ the game-changing results that we need to change the whole landscape and really allow you to meet those budget projections down the road?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say, and optimistically, that is the goal of the department and the mission, is to bend that curve so we are not building another prison starting in 2017. And, you know, from what we can see and with all the evidence-based programs that are available that we're embracing and implementing, by golly, I think if we can get there halfway there, we're making progress.
So what percentage, as a follow-up, of your overall budget last year, I think it was between 2 and 4%, was on substance abuse programs? It's a very small amount. And again, if I hearken back to Representative Madden's presentation, staunch Republican, very conservative, but really, you know, emphasized the need to put the resources up front and on the treatment end of things. You know, I mean, is this going to have the same impact as, you know, what they did in Texas, just straight up, I guess?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to think that eventually, yes. And, you know, keeping in mind that starting in, 2006, we've literally been building this from the ground up. And, you know, some of the challenges we face of growing too soon, but is we have challenges with community-based providers. So once the reentry process starts, you know, there's a lack of substance abuse treatment providers in the community. There's a lack of mental health providers. There's long waiting lists. And so I think, you know, over time, as is with our fellow departments and agencies, as we're looking at this as, you know, a collaborative effort, that, you know, the optimism is still there. And just with the early reports, you know, that we're seeing the early results and data from 2.5 years of substance abuse treatment, I mean, that's a little promising to see 14% at 2.5 years. We've got 6 more months to go before it can be, you know, that statistically valid pool of 3 years.
So with the existing resources that are in place, the department has the tools essentially to do these type of risk assessments for sort of all the incoming and outgoing, I was going to use the word patients, but I think it's more than a patient, your inmates.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. We are utilizing our current resources to be able to see where we are in our continuum of meeting the needs of those who are in our care our inmates, our probationers, and parolees.
Well, I appreciate the responses, but from what little I know, but I've had some exposure past 2.5 years, I'm skeptical. And, you know, I've got the benefit of being up in the Finance Committee and looking at all the trends, and there's a lot more coming your way. Look at the juvenile justice program, the OCS. I mean, there's a lot of trend lines that are going the wrong direction here in the state of Alaska. And I'm not perhaps as bullish as you are in terms of being able to bend that curve in the future, and particularly without incurring procuring some major resources along the way. So, questions, committee members? Representative Herr?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I looked over the programs and services document here, and I guess I just would like to request additional statistics on the two programs on page 22. Of course, you know that I've been real interested in having the department create domestic violence offender programs, and so at the next meeting, if you could provide some statistics so that I can defend those programs.
The Chair, Representative Herron, will be happy to provide the statistics.
Okay, with that, we do have a meeting on Thursday. For those of you who just arrived on the committee, inmate health care, do a budget recap and FY14 requests as well, should there be any outside of what we have before us. If there's anything more to come for the committee, we'll adjourn at 6:01 p.m.